Afternoon, evening, everyone. My name is Greta Fenner. I'm the Managing Director of the Basel Institute on Governance, and it's a great privilege to be your moderator today for this event on anti-corruption prosecutors under attack in the context of the 9th Conference of State Parties to the UN Convention Against Corruption. The event is organized by Norway and the Basel Institute on Governance, but we do so really on behalf of the Corruption Hunters Network. And let me start by saying a few words about the network. The Corruption Hunters Network is sponsored by Norway and was founded by what I would call a real hero and pioneer of anti-corruption prosecution, the great Eva Joly, who many of you have heard of or even had the pleasure of meeting. Eva was a so-called juge d'instruction. In other languages, we call it magistrate or quite straightforward prosecutor in France. And in this role, she took on many powerful individuals and companies for corruption, with the most famous of the cases that she was leading being in the 1990s, the Elf Aquitaine case. In her job and doing so, taking up these big corporations and powerful individuals, she was pressured from all sides and she received many threats to her life. She made huge personal sacrifices for the fight against corruption. And it is this experience that led her to create the Corruption Hunters Network. Now, I'm typically a skeptic when it comes to networks, because often the main purpose seems to be organizing conferences and international trips. But if there's one network, and I feel incredibly privileged to be a member of that network, that really makes a difference, then it is the Corruption Hunters Network. For its moral support, for its technical support, for its informality, and for the true and profound commitment of its members. So allow me to start by expressing my personal sincere appreciation and that of all network members to Norway for living up to Eva's legacy and giving many courageous prosecutors a family and a home where support is given in many different forms. That does lead me now to introduce, through a pre-recorded statement, Ms. Astrid Bergmal, who is the Secretary of State in the Ministry of Justice and Public Security of Norway. And she has pre-recorded a statement to open this side event. So over to my team, please, to go to the pre-recorded statement. Thank you.
Excellences, ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to welcome you all to this side event to pay tribute to the brave men and women who are doing their utmost to fight corruption and other related crimes. Corruption is a serious threat to sustainability and to the rule of law, where the few favor themselves at the expense of the many. Corruption weakens institutions and creates distrust between governments and the citizens. It affects and threatens the well-being of individuals by depriving the population from resources. Hence, fighting corruption is also a fight against poverty. It is sad that we have to use words as brave when it comes to the people who works to detect and report corruption, and law enforcement who respond by investigating and prosecuting. Norway is strongly committed to fight illicit financial flows and corruption. Arranging this side event is to show them our support. During the last 6 years, we have been presented by an impressive work by investigating reporters through a unique cooperation between journalists and media houses in all parts of the world. A work made possible due to whistleblowers. The leaks documented not only show how illicit funds continue to flow out of developing countries and into jurisdictions with high level of secrecy. The leaks also show the involvement in criminal activity by high-level public officials and other high-profile people, such as political leaders, and it reveals the connection to organized criminal networks. Furthermore, it is well documented that illicit financial flows are facilitated by professional enablers in both financial and non-financial sectors. In many countries, these cases are now being investigated and prosecuted. However, several challenges arise when large cases of corruption are brought to court, in particular cases with high-profile defendants. These high-profile defendants are often well-connected and influential, and they have the resources to pay the most experienced team of lawyers to defend them. and they put a spin on their case. Investigators, prosecutors, and judges have been exposed to political pressure, they have been publicly ridiculed, and they have received threats to safety, career, or advancement. Some have been physically attacked, and some even killed. Protecting law enforcement, prosecutors, and judges is to fulfill our obligation under the Convention Against Corruption. Norway is committed to continue to support UNODC and ICAR in their important work to providing technical assistance to developing countries. We will continue to support the Corruption Hunter Network, a well-resourced and robust prosecution that are able to work without interference of any kind is essential to stop financial flows and fight corruption. Because fighting corruption is also defending democracies, and law enforcement officers and prosecutors are our spearheads in this fight. I thank you for the attention.
Our sincere thanks. Please pass them on, Norway representatives, in particular Lise, to Ms. Bergmal for these true and very important statements. She mentioned the fight against corruption is really a fight against poverty, a fight for democracy, and by extension, a fight for all, and that our prosecutors and investigators are frontline defenders for all of us. Now, let me start with the panel. The way the session will be run is that we do have four fantastic panelists who will discuss some of their personal experiences in a sort of question answer style. And later on, we will have hopefully time to take also questions from the participants. In order to do so, you can either put them in the chat, which is visible to us panelists, and we will either answer these questions online or in person. But you can also use the raise your hand function if you'd like to ask your question personally, which is very much encouraged. We'd love to see you all. And if you raise your hand and I call upon you, our technical team will elevate you to be able to switch on your camera and unmute you. So with that, let's turn to our panelists. Very brief introductions. In alphabetical order, I should say, we start with Gary Bolch, who's the General Counsel of the International Association of Prosecutors. He will speak a little bit about why the IAP is important in the context of our topic, but I should also mention that Gary is a very senior prosecutor with lots of experience himself. He's also Deputy Chief Crown Prosecutor for England and Wales, and before joining the IAP, he was the head of CPS Proceeds of Crime. Joining us from Costa Rica is Grace Barrientos Núñez. She's a senior public prosecutor and will explain her work and her challenges in a minute. Suffice to say, it's a challenging job and even challenging to join us this morning because it's 4 a.m. in Costa Rica. So a huge thank you for Grace for joining us so early in the morning. I should mention Grace is, of course, a member of the Corruption Hunters Network. And we do have another member of the Corruption Hunters Network with us, Hermione Cronje, who's the head of the investigating directorate at the National Prosecuting Authority in Pretoria, South Africa. She's also worked, and I think we many of us know her also through the work she's done on asset recovery and anti-corruption with organizations like UNODC. And as I said, she's also a network member. And last, but certainly not least, is the director and co-founder of Global Witness, Simon Taylor. Global Witness, I think, is well known to many of us. I'm a little bit of a fan of Global Witness, I have to say. They do incredibly valuable work in uncovering, investigating, and reporting on corporate misuse, in particular in the areas of human rights, environmental destruction, and corruption. Now, I hope we can get Hermione to switch on her screen, because Hermione, you are the person to whom I'm going to ask the first question. Could you unmute yourself, Hermione, and give me a sign that you can hear me and perhaps even switch on your camera? Oh, wonderful. Here you are. Good morning. Oh, yeah, it's morning in South Africa. I'm not sure. Can you say something, Hermione, because I can't hear you?
Morning, Greta. Oh,
perfect. Wonderful. Thank you. Listen, it's no surprise that I want to talk to you about the Zuma case, which we have all been following over the many years unfolding. It's not a case, it's probably a complex of cases. So before we go into the challenges, And we have read about it, of course, in the newspaper. But could you give us the gist of this case? When did it start? What are the main crimes Mr. Zuma is accused of? Sort of a case in a nutshell, if that is really possible for a case of that size. Thank you.
Thanks, Greta. So when I received a set of questions to talk through this case, the first thing I did, obviously, was to call Billy Downer, who is the prosecutor leading this, has lived this case for the last 23 years. Billy, obviously, by now has recently been charged in this case, so he wasn't able to give you the account. He would have been the best person to give this account, but he felt that he was too close to the matter. When I started looking at how to present this case, it was utterly overwhelming, especially because I was told I'd have 5 minutes to explain this case. So you're going to have to bear with me while I try and give you what I think are the key highlights. The case arose out of an arms deal that the South African government decided to embark on in about 1996. That's 2 years into democracy, during the presidency of Nelson Mandela still. The arms deal was an enormous investment in improving South Africa's army, basically. The challenge was that, as everyone knows who's done work, anti-corruption work in the arms deal, usually is accompanied by a variety of role players who make it their business to introduce arms manufacturers to key and influential people. That is what happened here. The allegations, and unfortunately, they're still allegations in relation to Jacob Zuma. They are not allegations in relation to what we call the middleman who helped introduce Tint, which was a French arms company, to the then deputy president of the country, Jacob Zuma. Now, Jacob Zuma was from 1994 to 1999 was a member of the legislature in one of our provinces, and in that province he was Minister of Economic Affairs and Tourism. In July 1999, when revelations started to surface that there may have been significant corruption in the award of contracts in the arms deal, he had become deputy president of the country. The first significant decision taken in this case was when the first National Director of Public Prosecutions, Bulelani Ngcuka, publicly announced his decision to prosecute Shabir Sheikh, the middleman, and not to prosecute Jacob Zuma, the then deputy president of the country. And the reason given was, while there was a feeling that there was a winnable a prima facie case, there was not, he did not feel comfortable that we had a winnable case. Of course, the prosecution team led by Billy Downer did not share those views. They felt very strongly that it was important to charge the two together. But Shabir Sheikh went on to be convicted of the charges of corruption for corruptly buying Jacob Zuma's influence and ensuring in that way that he could facilitate contracts being awarded to people and himself receiving kickbacks in that way. So in a nutshell, that's what the case is about. But for the last 20 years, the prosecution of Jacob Zuma has not been able to take off. You described in the flyer that there are Stalingrad tactics that were deployed. So I have 5 pages of significant events of the kinds of challenges brought, the kinds of legal points taken, the significant turmoil that this case has resulted in, not just for the prosecutor personally, but for the prosecuting authority. The National Prosecuting Authority in South Africa was established in 1998 as a national body. To this day, we have not had a national director of public prosecutions that has completed their term. This case has been a significant factor in the tenure of each and every national director of public prosecutions. The prosecution team itself has had so many challenges from an onslaught in the courts, litigation after litigation, trying to impugn the investigation, trying to impugn prosecution decisions, but also there have been threats, a media campaign, a social media campaign that certainly I recently spoke to someone close to a member of the prosecution team, and he said to me, every time this case is called in court, I fear that some crazy lunatic will get up and just fire a shot. That's the kind of threats that have been or hanging over the head. In Billy's case, he has the notoriety of even being charged criminally for allegedly making available confidential information in relation to the case. I mean, this is a strategy that was used fairly effectively and is used fairly effectively in prosecution, other prosecutions that we're involved in, because prosecutors then get neutralized. Investigators get charges laid against them and they get neutralized because, like Billy, there's very little they can say to defend themselves. The matter's sub judice. You know, the law has to be seen to take its course when people make allegations. We do not have a sufficiently swift way in which we can determine that is a spurious complaint and move on. It has to go through the normal processes. And so I think one of the things we really need to look into here is how one can deal with these kinds of attacks more swiftly, especially when we are dealing, as we are in this case and other cases, with the most powerful people in the country. Here we're talking about someone who, after this, became president of the country for 9 years, who to this day has considerable public support or popular support. So how, when you take on the powerful like this, the powerful politicians, the powerful leaders in business, how do we ensure that we have a special dispensation for ensuring that we expeditiously get to the facts? Jacob Zuma has to this day not had to formally in a court of in a criminal court answer to the allegations. This is 20 years after the allegations were first made. Let me just, you know, there's so much that can be said about this case, but it continues to capture the South African imagination. Just yesterday, we had another judgment. In the midst of all of this, the Commission of Inquiry was set up to probe whether during Jacob Zuma's tenure as president, so unrelated to the arms deal cases we've just been discussing, but during his tenure as president of the country, was the state captured? Were key institutions of government put at the disposal of private interests to advance those private interests? The Commission of Inquiry called Jacob Zuma to answer some of the allegations made. He refused to appear, or he failed to appear. He was civilly charged and committed to custody for contempt of court. He served a few weeks in court and then was released by our Commission of Correctional Services on the basis that his health was so dire and so desperate that he could no longer be held in custody. Just as an aside, the same happened to Shabir Sheikh. Billy Downer obtained a conviction against Shabir Sheikh. He was sentenced to serve a 15-year jail sentence, but was released long before he served his time. on the basis that his health was failing. Well, he's still with us and seems to be doing just fine. The same efforts were made by Jacob Zuma, and our courts just yesterday ordered that Jacob Zuma be returned to custody to serve the balance of his contempt of court sentence, because the reasons given for his release did not stand up to scrutiny. So, as I say, I can carry on, but I can see that you need to move on to the next question.
I think you've captured so much, Hermione, you know, in terms of you've given really good examples. And I think what's also shocking is, I mean, we are talking about individual prosecutors who are being really hindered in executing their work. But in South Africa, the way I understand you, it has really impacted the effectiveness of the entire national criminal justice system. So the harm it can do goes even much further than what, you know, that one case, which is of incredible significance. So I think that's the point that is really, really, really important to take away. Perhaps I'll move on to Simon for now, but we're very happy to come back to you, Hermione, and I think also explore some of the suggestions you've made. And also, you know, if there is space for more examples of how Billy, and I really want to give a big shout out to Billy here, who thankfully enjoying a few days of leave at the moment, well deserved, or so he says, you know, for this. So we can come back to that perhaps later. But Simon, if we can start just in a couple of sentences before we go into the case complex that you want to discuss, you want to present to us. Just what brings Global Witness to this panel? Why is Global Witness concerned with prosecution in anti-corruption?
Well, it's a multi sort of headed answer, I suppose, to this, because it really relates to literally everything that we do as an organization. So we set up to look at the links between environmental exploitation and human rights abuses, as that's how we defined ourselves at the beginning. So we weren't a human rights organization, nor an environmental organization. And all too often, the situation on the ground is something that the glue is corruption, corrupt acts by public officials with companies or mafia operators who essentially come in, it takes two to tango, and they're corrupt officials and they illicitly obtain advantage. And so if you're concerned about trying to stop environmental destruction, driving conflicts, or in fact, even the looting of whole countries, which we've also documented, you need to deal with the corruption side.
It's one thing I've been saying for so long in relation to every one of the sustainable development goals, you know, unless you manage to reduce and, well, you'll never reduce it to zero, but reduce corruption, you will never be able to achieve any of these goals. It's a pretty sad reality, I find. And I couldn't agree more with your point, especially in the environment and resources, which are areas which are so exposed to corruption. And you know, our Green Corruption Program precisely looks at exactly that, but in a very different way than you. So excellent complementarity, as we like to say. Environment often involves, as I said, natural resources, oil fields and exploitations. And one of the companies that has occasionally made headlines in the newspapers is, of course, the Italian company Eni. And I know that Global Witness and you personally, with a few colleagues, some of which are also with us today in the audience, have looked at this case very closely. Can you tell us a little bit about what are the issues with the prosecution in Italy, first and foremost, I would say, but also in connection with any cases in other jurisdictions? And is there anything we can learn from these cases in terms of, you know, methods or typologies of attack? How prosecutors are discredited, undermined, and perhaps also similarities to what we just heard from Hermione in South Africa.
Maybe I should just really explain how we got into this and what the case is very briefly, and then go on to those bits. So the case in question relates to the acquisition of an oil field known as the OPL 245 oil field. It was considered West Africa's largest offshore oil field. It's a Nigerian oil field. And it was acquired by a shell company called Malibu Oil and Gas. That company was set up by the dictator Sani Abacha's oil minister, who, when he was minister, gave his company the asset. And to the deal and the whole case that we're talking about relates to a period just over a decade later, when both Shell and Eni acquired this asset through what we consider to be a corrupt deal. We wait to see how the prosecution will end up, because we've just seen the end of the preliminary case, the court of first instance, and now there is an appeal that will be heard in the year to come. And we presume this could go up further beyond that, depending on the outcome of the case. So essentially, we consider it to be a corrupt deal because the asset was corruptly obtained. It was essentially a looted state asset given to an oil minister by himself, and then he monetized it. And it wasn't just him. There were other individuals who gained from the transfer of money. And the amount paid was just over $1 billion. Some of it got frozen in London. And our involvement came in because we collectively, with our colleagues in the UK NGO, the Corner House, the Italian NGO, ReCommon, and the Nigerian NGO, HEDA, were the complainants in a number of different jurisdictions. The first three of us were in Milan, and with HEDA, we are complainants in the Netherlands, and also in Nigeria, where there's an investigation still going on in the Netherlands, and there are cases underway in Nigeria. And of course, the Italian case kick-started out of that. And the Milan Public Prosecutor's Office did an amazing investigation, I mean, over a period of time. And the case was filed against both companies. And I'm trying to remember the number now, some 17 defendants in total, if you count the two companies as well. These consisted of the current CEO of Eni, the previous CEO of Eni, the person who was in charge of their whole sort of world upstream development works on the Shell side. It was the former number two who was in charge of their global upstream operation, someone in charge of African upstream development, a couple of ex-MI6 officers. There are a bunch of spies in this story. It's quite interesting. Or ex-spies. Is anyone ever an ex-spy? I don't know. And a whole bunch of assorted middlemen, variously describable, perhaps as sort of semi-borderline mafia types. It's quite hard to say who they are and who they really work for. Anyway, they invented this mechanism to circuit paying directly to Malibu Oil and Gas itself, and they use the government. The Economist described this as safe sex, the government becoming the condom, if you like, so in order to give cover to the companies. Anyway, the prosecution ended with acquittal in March this year. The other cases I referred to are still potentially ongoing or actually ongoing, and so we can't speak about what will happen with those. And as I said, the Milan case has been appealed and supported by the Federal Republic, which is a civil party to the case as well. Now, when the case concluded in March, we sort of entered a period of, I don't quite know how to describe it, vitriol might be a good word. An enormous sort of attack across the media focused on the prosecutors themselves. There was a sort of insight into how some of this might go when two of the indictees were prosecuted in an expedited case previously and were convicted. And in their appeal process, one of the, or rather the appeal prosecutor seemed to me, I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing, but if I was to sort of describe it in a party, I might say sort of put their hands up and surrendered, and even described the entire process as a waste of public resources, in effect. I don't have the quote to hand, but that's not really the point. The sort of description of why are we wasting our time prosecuting things like this? This is essentially ridiculous. And Italy's obliged to prosecute corruption where there are grounds to suspect and where an investigation is conducted. And that's what happened. So the idea that you could have a prosecutor who's supposed to be supporting an appeal essentially put their hands up and say, this is a waste of money, I find really quite shocking. And there's a real problem there. The attacks I mentioned really began in earnest beyond just in the media itself, and have now taken the form of an investigation, and now we believe charges leveled against the main prosecutor and his assistant prosecutor, ostensibly for not handing over a video to the other side. It turns out the other side, namely Eni, had a transcript of this video all along, and that's supported by the court documents. It's very clear in the public domain. We know that they had this material all along. And in addition, there's another part of the allegation relates to an incomplete investigation by different prosecutors into a different matter. And the prosecutors used their discretion, which they're entitled to. I mean, this is something that you would think should be supported by Article 30 of UNCAC, that there's, you know, there's a discretionary ability of prosecutors, and that should be supported. So as far as we're concerned, the allegations against prosecutors are really absurd and unfounded. And if we were to sort of sum them up, I guess I would put them in the box of in the absence of a better explanation, it looks like a deliberate effort to undermine the ability of the prosecutors to actually be the ones in court supporting their appeal process. And when you take this into account with other matters that are of major concern, specifically around a number of cases that have big corruption cases that have concluded, or including also this first instance case for this particular case I'm referring to, it's hard not to conclude that Italy is now completely out of sync with its obligations under the OECD Convention, which, if true, essentially means Italy is wide open as a jurisdiction where, as an Italian company, you can go ahead and do what you like, basically. You can go ahead and corrupt people. Let's face it, it is a proactive, I mentioned before, it takes two to tango. And you can do so in the full knowledge that there's no hope in hell of actually being nailed for it, which is a real problem. And I would just perhaps end with this bit of our conversation with pointing out perhaps the obvious, but I think still nevertheless shocking sort of conclusion, which is when you get corruption that bleeds countries dry, it is a matter of life and death for many people. And we should not be under any surprise where we have states in semi-degrees of failure, where we have mass migration of individuals. And Italy, as a frontline state, has sadly been on the brunt. And, you know, that's an indictment, I think, of European nations collectively, including the UK, I would add, it's not an EU thing. It includes the UK, sorry. It's an indictment of the European effort to distribute people migrating from harm's way more fairly. But Italy's been on the front line of this migration. And here we have essentially Italy now aiding and abetting its corporations to conduct corrupt deals, which will only make this worse, which I think is a real travesty. So there are these, just to sum up, there are these real concerns about Italy dropping out of compliance with the OECD Convention. And what the hell is going on, pardon the way I framed that, with attacks against the prosecutors who've done nothing but prosecute the company based on the evidence before? And if you sat in that court case and heard what was said, it is quite shocking the conclusion that case came to. Perhaps I'll stop with that.
No, that's fantastic, Simon. Thank you so much. I mean, I think you were referring to the fact that there were some spies involved, and I think there's material enough for John Le Carré to write a few books in this case. I would imagine we should perhaps see if that's an option. I think we do actually have participants from the OECD in the audience, and I do hope sincerely that they have heard you, and I'm sure they have. And we'll look into this very carefully. And I think, you know, you started and ended with two really important connections, the one with corruption undermining pretty much any environmental goal anyway, and sustainable development goal in particular, more broadly, but also the connection with, you know, corruption by a company from your own country may actually economically look like benefiting your country. And who cares whether it bleeds another country? They're far away, but it may well come back and bite you in the back. And unless we recognize these connections, is clearly that, you know, there's clearly no interest or perhaps the wrong incentive. It is, however, also a very complicated message to tell anyone, and especially when you're a politician, to explain these connections and make your choices understandable in view of these if you actually want to do so. So I think just picking up one point from your presentation and then moving on to Graysa. One of the typologies, frankly, I would call it sue the other for whatever, because, you know, in a way it's like you just file a case against this prosecutor or sue them for this and that. It doesn't matter if there is any substance to it, but it's definitely going to make this person look weak, perhaps even force that person to be taken off the case. And if none of that, it's just going to delay the case forever. And that is in the interest you mentioned crazy sums in our preparatory calls about the amount of money that any spent for its legal defense. Mind blowing. But let's move on to Graysa. For now, we will not let Italy or any get off the hook all that fast. But let's move to Costa Rica for now. Graysa, good morning again. Let's start by just, if you could just start by telling us a little bit about our work, your work, and the main challenges that you face, and then we can perhaps later come to a comparison with what you've just heard from South Africa and Italy.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Greta. And thank you, NORAD and Basel Institute and Norway for having this very interesting session. You know, I have been a prosecutor for almost 26 years. During that time, I've been in charge of investigating many corruption, finance, and economic cases. Along my years as a prosecutor, I have encountered many situations when investigating powerful, important, or political related people, the way many lawyers, because they have not only one lawyer, the very powerful people have just a team of lawyers in charge of many in charge of media, in charge of their civil case, in charge of their criminal case. And they use the use of excessive procedures and to present unnecessary claims to the judge, expecting not to face a formal accusation or even delaying the trial and the criminal procedure in general. When they're running out of legal arguments, they begin the personal attacks against the prosecution.
So it's interesting because you also come up with this sort of unnecessary claim as one of the points that you made, and the enormous pockets of those criminals. And you also hinted already at how one of these defendants can really derail an entire criminal justice system. And I think that sounds very similar. So what is it that makes your job particularly hard, perhaps in Costa Rica or probably also comparatively speaking with others? I mean, you've obviously exchanged a lot of your experiences with the corruption hunters. Have you ever experienced anything like what we just heard from Italy or South Africa? Can you tell us a bit your own take on this?
Yes, one story that I can recall from many, unfortunately, that I have and that I can tell because the trial is over and the appeal proceedings are over. Some years ago, prosecution, we presented formal charges against a very important public officer and others for embezzlement of public funds in abuse of one social government program. In fact, was the main social program of that government. He was a very important person. One of them was a very important person. He was appointed by the second vice president of the Republic as the coordinator or the chief of this committee in charge of the administration of the social fund. The court at the beginning ordered him to be taken into preventive custody for a period of 6 months, but granted bail because he offered to cooperate and offer to us to show us many irregularities in the government because he was very close of this high-ranking officer. So he brought, and we seized, a big amount of documents. While the prosecution was analyzing the documents and the evidence, he escaped to Canada for almost 3 years. The investigation continued against the other defendants. Meanwhile, the court ordered the application of this special procedure that we have under our criminal procedure code for processing complex investigations because of the high number of documents, the high number of witnesses, facts involved in the case. Of course, we issued an international arrest warrant against him. He claimed asylum based on persecution for political issues in Canada in order to obtain refugee status, because he argued that the case against him was a consequence of being under a politically motivated investigation. But finally, after 3 years, the motion was denied and he was finally deported, although we asked for the extradition, of course. By this time, we had done the trial against other defendants and they were already sentenced for to serve 14 years in prison for this same investigation. So back into Costa Rica, he had to face criminal charges being in preventive custody. He asked the court, being in prison, that he needed to analyze all the documents in person, all the documents of the investigation. I remember that it was a whole room full of documents, a warehouse that we have in the prosecution office. And not only the documents that we've gathered, but the documents that he, at the beginning of the investigation, told us that were very important to the case. He was brought in custody for, I remember, a week or so in a special room so that he can analyze and prepare his defense with his lawyer, always guarded by the police. I remember him taking notes and making an inventory of all the documents and evidence. Once he presented the evidence for trial before the court, we sent all the documents to court with all form and requirements. This case in against him was kind of a novel because we began that trial for almost 3 months of witnesses. When we discovered that he and his lawyer and one of his lawyers had, because of a whistleblower, we find out that he had hundreds of phone calls with one of the judges. When we discovered that, the judge was taken out of the court, and so we had to begin again that trial. The first day of this, again, another trial against him, he asked the court to take us both, because we were two prosecutors, out of the case, because he had filed criminal charges against us, expecting and seeking also civil reparations from us, because he had also filed a civil claim as a victim. He argued that there was evidence that was destroyed because it was disappeared, that he had looked at it and analyzed it when he was brought to look at it. But when the evidence was taken to court, there were hundreds, that's what he said, of documents missing. He argued that since we were the ones keeping the documents and the evidence was under our custody, we were the ones that destroyed. I'm telling you all this part of the story so that you can understand that in a complex corruption case like this, taking out the prosecutors in trial was very strategic. We knew the case from the beginning. We already participated in the trial against the other accused that were convicted. And we knew all the details concerning this case. By this time, he had tried anything without success. He presented criminal charges against us, arguing that we had destroyed evidence. And he presented like a 20-page list of hundreds of documents, a very detailed list with the documents that he argued were missing indicating details on each and every one, each and every document. The court asked us to explain where were those documents. The documents were stored in files, not individually. So he was taking advantage of this. He was asking the court about specific documents, as I said, for example, documents signed. He said one document with a number 64 in the upper left side, signed by this person of this institution in a red pen signature. And that's the kind of description that he gave, very detailed. So the court asked us for an explanation. The trial continued. The court ruled that the criminal charges were not an argument to take us out, but we had to give an explanation to court in the trial. We have to give an explanation in the criminal case against us and in the disciplinary case that we had, that he also filed against us too. At first, I thought that the documents were in the prosecutor document warehouse. We spent weekends looking for them because we were on trial at this time. We spent 1 year in that trial, hundreds of witnesses and thousands of documents. We spent most of the 5 days from Monday through Friday on trial. On Friday afternoon, court gave us time to prepare the documents for next week's, for example, witnesses. So I spent weeks and almost months of the year on Friday afternoons looking into the files that were brought as evidence by the defense, because now I began searching for them in court of the documents that he we presented to court, trying to find each and every one of the documents that he claimed we destroyed, just to find out that they were among the evidence offered by him and accepted by the court, but offered as files, not as individual documents. In between all the files, where I can found, I found, for example, one document, three or four boxes later, a file with one of the documents that he asked the court that it was missing. He used that strategy because he was running out of legal arguments and desperately needed to question in trial the investigation and the prosecution. Meanwhile, I had to defend myself in a criminal procedure, and finally I got to demonstrate the scam, but it took me a long time and a lot of energy from me. Sometimes it's frustrating because you have to focus all your energy on the trial, examination, cross-examination of witnesses that are sometimes experts. So you have to study, analyzing the documents. You have to have on trial particular attention on media, working hard to explain the case to court, and also deal with this kind of strategies makes you tired. Finally, he was sentenced to 16 years of prison for embezzlement of public funds. And many years later, after the trial, he was sentenced for false, or what under our criminal code, we call malicious accusation or false accusation against us, and was sentenced to 6 years in prison also. But for example, today in an ongoing investigation on corruption, one of the accused, because there have no more legal arguments, he presented criminal charges against some witnesses and against three of the prosecutors, including me, and pretended to take us out of the case in the latest hearings, I think that 3 weeks ago. Fortunately, the judge ruled not to take us out because he presented no legal arguments besides the allegedly criminal charge against us. But I have to defend myself of these allegations. You never get used to this kind of strategies, but they're more common than you think. The abuse of legal strategies, including attacks against you, because it's not only that they present the criminal charge against you, but they present themselves to media as a victims, and you suddenly appear in newspapers, and that undermines sometimes your work and takes away your energy and the effort that you need to focus on your work. Fortunately for me, I have been supported by my superiors and colleagues till now, but I know that in some cases, this is not the case on some prosecutors around the world. And the damage, I think, that is not caused only to the case, but to the legal system, the democracy, and to the country, allowing corruption to win these kinds of battles. Thank you, Britt.
Grace, this is incredible. I'm really grateful and hugely appreciate that you're sharing this story. And I'd like to add that, you know, as a strategy, exhausting a prosecutor is probably a very effective strategy. Just, you know, making you work so hard, having to handle the actual case, your own defense, having to deal all of a sudden with the media attention, probably also in your personal context, people who start seeing you differently because they've read things about you in the newspapers and how that affects you at a very, very personal level. And having the stamina, the courage, the energy, Graza, and with you, the other prosecutors who are represented here today, you know, to keep going is really blowing my mind away. And I think blowing the mind away of everyone who's just heard you. So you spoke. So first of all, thank you, Graza. You spoke about the support you had from colleagues and your superiors. I think the superiors are incredibly important here. And indeed, not every prosecutor, we have quite a few in the audience having suffered these kinds of challenges, have had the support. So it's great to hear that. Support from colleagues brings me to Gary, because he represents, of course, the International Association of Prosecutors, so an association of many colleagues, right? And we've just heard now, Gary, the stories, three countries, three continents. The stories are different, but frankly, they're also very, very similar. And in a way, it's almost like, you know, this word lawfare just comes to mind, of course. And I think, Simon, we spoke about lawfare as well. And it seems to be raging across the world. There is no difference from one region to the other, no difference whether your country's very sophisticated legal system or perhaps still sort of, you know, more in a developing stage. But it's a real challenge. And I would appreciate, Gary, if you could now talk a little bit about the support that the IAP, for example, can provide, but also other thoughts that you might have in terms of more systemic responses to trying to fight back against this lawfare.
Thank you, Greta. Yes, of course. Just for those who are perhaps not familiar with the International Association of Prosecutors, we're a global association. We have organizational members, that's prosecuting authorities and associations of prosecutors in 177 countries and territories around the world. The accounts do sound familiar and depressingly familiar. Is it lawfare? That's an interesting question. I'll come back to that a little later on. I have to say, not all attacks on prosecutors are referred to the IAP, so we don't have the complete picture, but certainly anecdotal evidence and indeed the increased activity of our Standing Committee on Prosecutors in Difficulty suggests an upward trend and a worrying trend. So the Standing Committee is the mechanism through which the IAP assists prosecutors in distress, and I'll expand a little on its governance process and activity. The Standing Committee was established in 2013 as we recognised the growing threat prosecutors were facing in the performance of their professional duties, and it's governed by a protocol which is approved by our membership. The Standing Committee is comprised of three senior and experienced prosecutors, and by senior I mean prosecutor general level, and they're drawn from our Executive Committee and Senate, and they're elected for three-year terms by the Executive Committee. So whenever a prosecutor, prosecuting agency, or association of prosecutors claims to be in difficulty and requests assistance, the function of that committee is to investigate the request, determine whether it has substance, and advise on any response. And we'll take forward requests where there's either been a breach of the IAP standards, these set out the duties and rights of prosecutors, or a breach of other relevant international legal instruments such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I think it's worth saying a few words about the standards, as they require institutional and functional independence of prosecutors, with Articles 2 and 6 addressing those issues directly, and I think they're worth quoting. Article 2 states that prosecutorial discretion should be exercised independently and free from political interference. And Article 6 states that prosecutors should be entitled to perform their professional duties without intimidation, hindrance, harassment, improper interference, or unjustified exposure to civil, penal, or other liability, and that together with their families, to be physically protected by the authorities when their personal safety is threatened as a result of their functions. So the types of cases that are referred to our standing committee vary considerably, but it is possible to identify some typologies, and I think you'll agree that they reflect the accounts we've heard from the previous speakers. So first of all, we deal with direct threats to prosecutors. They may come from either internal or external sources, and they can range from low-level harassment, such as removal from or downgrading of role or duties, to threats to personal safety, and ultimately physical attacks, which sadly, on occasion, have proved fatal. Second, at the more subtle end of the spectrum, attempts may be made to undermine the independence of prosecutors through inappropriate legislation that either limits their prosecutorial discretion or facilitates their removal from office without due cause or process. A third category, and this has been talked about a lot by the previous speakers, it is perhaps best described as an extension of the Stalingrad defence. That defence seems to involve to include satellite, civil, and other litigation to delay or halt the criminal proceedings or attack the character of the prosecutor. And as we've heard and observed recently in South Africa, it's extended to the filing of criminal complaints against the prosecutor in a so far unsuccessful attempt to get him removed from a high profile corruption case. And can I just say that Billy Downer is a long standing and committed member of the IP, and he has our unwavering support. In terms of responses, we have to be circumspect. Even when a request has substance, some requests are more suitable for resolution through a country's own legal mechanisms, meaning that formal interventions by the IP are not always required. But where it is, we try to achieve an outcome that addresses the basis of the request and promotes the rule of law. I guess ultimately, it's the moral authority the IP can bring to bear that resolves matters. And when that authority is backed by multilateral institutions, it has greater clout. So a coordinated response from the international community is essential. And this is particularly so in the context of corruption. The greatest dangers lie at the intersection of corrupt political elites and organized crime. Physical attacks aside, that is where the threat to prosecutorial independence is highest, and the greatest and most long-lasting damage can be done to prosecuting institutions. In my view, one, if not the most important elements in a successful criminal justice response to corruption is political will. And political will is equally essential to protect anti-corruption fighters, both at an individual level and an institutional level. Finally, I would say that many of the problems flowing from the lawfare you describe are really an equality of arms issue. Inadequately resourced public prosecutors are simply outgunned by the huge and expensive legal teams that well-resourced defendants deploy. To that extent, lawfare is not unlike warfare. The biggest and best equipped side usually wins. Thank you, Greta.
Thank you very much, Gary, and thank you to IAP for the extremely important work you really do. It is one of the how should I say, really important tools that give, I think, also really hope to those prosecutors and support in a very practical way, but also sort of trying to look at the things from a more systemic perspective and trying to find systemic solutions. And I have in particular noted the point you made about sometimes really inappropriate legislation. And I think we need to look at these issues at least two levels, if not three. One is really giving support to individual prosecutors who are in distress. Be flexible in doing so, fast in doing so, taking them out if necessary, if there's a support to their, a threat to their life. Let's not forget their families and the implications, and really be able to help very, very immediately. Secondly, also at a personal level, this collegial support that is really sometimes, I think, it's not going to make the problem go away. But I do think that I've heard, certainly from people like Billy and so on, just having others reaching out to him. Or yesterday, Billy was actually a runner-up together with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists to win the first ever award for Financial Crime Fighter 2021, awarded by a global coalition to fight financial crime. In the end, David Lewis from FATF won. But, I think, small things like that also do help. At least it gives you a little bit of the resolve. But I do think that ultimately we need to look at the systemic or systems relevant points. And I think being very, very careful at looking where the legislation may really be too weak, and then perhaps also trying to understand why is it so? And that's where the political will comes in, Is it, and I find this is one of the most complicated questions and difficult to evaluate, is a law weak? Because, it wasn't well drafted, people didn't know better, we didn't have that experience yet. Or is it badly drafted because it's very inconvenient to have bad laws? And, I'm a suspicious kind of person. I usually lean towards the latter, but I don't want to kind of, condemn everything. We do have a bit of time left, actually, and I would like to bring in perhaps questions from the floor as well as but obviously also give you the space to react to each other in a minute. I do want to point, because the participants can't see that, only we panelists can, there is Hannah Ahern from the DC-based Due Process of Law Foundation who shared, and that we can perhaps put that on our social media or so, also views from Latin America. And it's a short text, so perhaps I can just read it to you. It says, in Latin and Central America in particular, we're witnessing a growing trend in forced exiles as a form of attack against independent prosecutors and judges, particularly those who fight against corruption in contexts marked by increasing authoritarian tendencies and the resulting threats to independent judiciaries. In the case of Guatemala, there are currently 17 Guatemalan ex-prosecutors and judges in forced exile because of arrest warrants against them. She goes on to say, when justice operators are forced to flee their country, as we have seen in the case of many from Central America, they are essentially prevented from defending themselves in their own countries against often spurious charges. We would like to hear from the panelists about A, whether they know of similar cases from other contexts around the world, and if there have been any examples of how anti-corruption prosecutors have been able to continue to successfully investigate corrupt networks from outside of their countries. So it is a comment, but it's also a question. She's also sharing a recent article from ex-anti-corruption prosecutor Juan Francisco Sandoval, which we will make sure we can have that in our social media feed on this event and share with everyone. So I don't know if someone would like to react from the panelists. I do have one hand up also from Lorenzo Salazar. I will give you the floor in a minute. Mr. Salazar, representing Italy and the delegation to the OECD Convention on Foreign Bribery. Let me turn to our panelists first and see whether perhaps you have a reaction to Hannah's very pertinent question and comment. Yes, Hermione, please go ahead. You've got to unmute yourself, though.
Got it. That's better. I don't have any examples of where a prosecutor was able to continue the fight outside of the country, never mind outside of the organization. Because what tends to happen is charges are brought and immediately the cloud of suspicion then hangs over that prosecutor, whether there is merit or no merit whatsoever in the case. In the case of Billy Downer, for example, while the charge in itself, on the face of it, seemed spurious. And the prosecuting authority did issue a statement saying it noted this charge was concern. It still creates the expectation now that he'll need to be removed while this charge is fully investigated and prosecuted to conclusion. I'm hoping that won't be the case. But as I was saying earlier, I think it's really important to find a mechanism, and maybe it can be a regional mechanism or an international mechanism, or even where an independent body, because the minute you charge the prosecutor, you're putting the prosecution on trial, and you're saying the prosecution now has to defend itself. So to create sort of independent mechanisms where there can be a swift resolution of those kinds of matters, and sort of a special track, because of course not all charges against prosecutors are without merit. We have seen many charges that have merit, where prosecutors have been bribed and there has been misconduct. So it is of course important to have a credible mechanism to consider how these matters must be dealt with. But I suspect that another issue to consider, and it goes to the inequality of arms point, really. When, you know, in ordinary matters and run-of-the-mill prosecutions, these are not issues that we worry about too much. But when you're taking on the powerful, the most powerful in the country, you have to be better prepared. You know, when the national director first decided that we weren't prosecuting Jacob Zuma back in 2003, I think it was, because although we had a prima facie case, they weren't certain that we would win in court. That speaks to, and you know, in South Africa, volumes have been written about whether that was an appropriate thing to do. But what it speaks to is when you decide to take on the powerful and the politically powerful, the economically powerful, what do you need in your armory, and how do you support people? It can't be a lone prosecutor going out there. And often it is. Often it is in some of our very serious cases, you have one or two prosecutors running enormous cases with enormous consequence. So that resource issue, you know, you were talking about law and whether the laws are adequate. Often the resources are hopelessly inadequate for us to be able to mount these prosecutions. So it would be good if we could kind of put out the kind of resource or what is a well-equipped prosecution team to take on serious corruption and serious commercial crime, so that countries can benchmark themselves against, you know, are we seriously up for this? You know, we can announce charges, announce arrests, but know that actually nothing will happen because we just don't have the capacity to see this through. So I just wanted to throw that in. Thanks, Greta.
Thank you, Irma. And I think the point you made is also, in a way, that in itself is again a waste of resources, because on the one hand, you invest a lot in these really important charges, but then you're not given the resources to go through with them. So actually, to start with, you know, might as well not start, which is of course not what I'm recommending. But in a way, if you look at it from that point, and also yesterday or the day before yesterday at the Star Day, I was also saying, you know, I do realize that a lot of countries are struggling with, you know, of course we don't have endless resources, and there's education and the health system and the roads and the infrastructure and everything else that needs money. But if you look at the impact that law enforcement can have to prevent and deter the very reason why we have limited resources to put them in schools and health, that again, it would be, it's a difficult political message to put through. Sorry, we can't build more schools because we need to equip our anti-corruption prosecutors with more money, because we always want short-term gain. We want to be reelected. But the long-term impact of that would be really important to stress. But I think we will move on, actually, and I will. We do have a few. Sorry, I'm trying to monitor the questions here. We do have Lorenzo Salazar. No, it's actually Giovanni Taragaglia Polcini, former chair of the G20 Anti-Corruption Working Group, Italian delegate to the OECD, who is using Lorenzo Salazar's account, who would like to come in and speak. So can I ask my team to promote Lorenzo Salazar to speaker for a moment? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not Lorenzo again. I'm using the wrong name again. Apologies. Go ahead.
The name is Lorenzo, but my name is Giovanni Tartaglia Polcini. I hope that you can hear me well. We can try, so it's better.
There's still quite a significant echo,
okay, we are,
but let's.
The conference of the state parties here in Egypt and in person. Let me say before, thank you for organizing this side event. And you have presented me, and I thank you also for this. And we, as Italian coordination of the international activity against corruption, consider very relevant the inclusion of the non-governmental organizations, civil society, business sector, and media in the debate and in decision proceedings in this field. Personally, I promoted as chair of G20 Anti-Corruption Working Group a lot of insertions of reference to the freedom of media and reference to the multi-stakeholder approach in our documents. Okay, let's try. It's
I think we've just lost our colleague, so perhaps I'm sure he's going to come back. But we do have other questions, and I think one here is another guest in the audience, Olan Revaju Suraju. Sorry for not pronouncing your name, I'm sure, properly. Would you like to come in and ask your question in person, please?
Thank you very much, Greta. Can you hear me?
Perfect. Excellent.
Oh, thank you very much. And then thanks to the panelists. And I think it's just important to also share the experience of the anti-corruption czar in Nigeria by the name Ibrahim Magu, who actually was unfortunately consumed by the circumstances that the Italian prosecutor Fabio Pasquale and Spadaro are actually going through. Unfortunately, Magu was not only set up, he was fabricated, faced with fabricated allegations, suspended from office, persecuted, detained, and as it is now, still undergoing persecution. And I think it is important that we find a platform, and thanks to the Anti-Corruption Corruption Hunters Network and a few others that are also speaking up, we need to also find means of ensuring that we hold accountable some of the state actors. So some of them, Nigeria is at the UNCACOSP meeting, making some fantastic, how should you say, fantabulous presentations about Nigeria's fight against corruption. Very ridiculous, but nobody's asking the question of what happened to the anti-corruption advocates in the country that are facing persecution. I mean, these are people actually working for the government in anti-corruption. And the whole essence of the OPL 245 that Simon Taylor spoke about was also with thanks to the contribution and effort of Ibrahim Magu in Nigeria. But the Nigerian government is getting away with that blue mother. So I think it would be important that going forward, some of the platform where they have the opportunity of coming to do a kind of scorecard, like UNCAC's Conference of State Parties meeting, we confront them sufficiently with some of these facts. So that we can encourage the anti-corruption advocates that they also have support outside, you know, the government or wherever that they would need when victimization comes around. I thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming in. I think you're raising a few important points, and I'm glad to have the name of a dear colleague of ours mentioned indeed, and that is one of the many stories, sadly. And a colleague of mine, Jovile from Uganda, just mentioned in the chat as well that in fact in Uganda, and I know a similar story in Malawi, where a lead prosecutor in one high profile case was murdered, and we have the same situation in Malawi. And both murder cases, according to Jovile for Uganda, and as far as I know in Malawi, have not been resolved at all, and the investigations have been gone for many years. Tightened security for prosecutors is also a topic which is often really far from adequate. I remember having driven in the car of the lead anti-corruption prosecutors in Peru, and I can tell you I didn't feel particularly safe. That was not a safe car to be driving in. I do want to give the floor back to our colleague from Italy. We do have 13 minutes left, lots of questions and points to raise. So everyone that I'm giving the floor now, please keep it quite tight. Thank you very much. Over to you, please, again.
Thank
Let's
you.
Hope the sound is better.
Can you hear me now?
Better? That's much better, yes. Great, thank you.
We have resolved going out of the main room.
Now you've gone on mute again, unfortunately.
Please, now? Yeah.
Yes, please.
Exactly. I want to share my vision as Italian delegation to the Conference of the State Party on some of the items we have heard. But before doing so, I want to share in general our approach to the multi-stakeholder approach, exactly as I said before.
Okay. Can I just please ask you to keep it really to 2 minutes so that we give
yes,
the others
time?
Yes,
I go very quickly, but okay. I have
Thank
to
you.
Just to...
2 minutes. Thank you.
Yes. Just to give my contribute to the reconstruction of reality. We have, as Italian delegation, every time sustained a multi-shareholder approach in this field, exactly also looking at the prosecutor's activity at the main trials, investigations all around the world and also inside our country. But we have also exactly in mind that our constitution provides for the total independence of judges and prosecutors from any kind of interference. And this is a matter of fact. And so when we speak about investigations of prosecutors, we have to take in account that in cases as the one you have mentioned, you have a prosecutor totally independent from other branches, executive, parliamentary, and other interference. And another magistrate is the judge who decided the acquittal in the first phase. And you have another prosecutor, also independent, who is investigated independently from any kind of interference on this case. Only to give our point of view on the facts. It is relevant because mm-hmm. we can't now say that Italy is not compliant with the convention if we refer to a case is pending now. We don't know what will be the final decision on the pending investigation in favor or against our colleague. I am a prosecutor too. I can speak also as a prosecutor mm-hmm, too. Mm-hmm. But we have to take in account our constitutional framework. We are not speaking about interference from government or from parliamentary or other undue interference. There is total independence in our legal framework provided for constitutional law. It is a unique case all around the world sure. for judges and prosecutors. And to reconstruct the reality, we need also to air this voice on the case. Thank you for
absolutely
permitting me to intervene you, and congratulations for your activities as Besan Institute, as an ONG, on defending the independence of prosecutors all around the world. It is perfectly in line with our vision for a new era of enforcement and the rule of law. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you coming in and presenting these points. I would like, I know, Simon, you have your hand up. Allow me to give one more person from the audience. First the floor, Abdul Alekri, but I will come back to you, Simon, so that you can also react. Abdul, can you please come in? Thank you.
Yes, do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you, thank you.
Well, I would like to put another aspect of order of the public prosecutor, and I give example of Lebanon. You know that there is now, it is more than 1 year since the horrible Beirut port explosion, which is equal to like an atomic bomb. And since then, there has been three prosecutors. I mean, then there is a prosecutor who is appointed, and then after some time, it's being pressurized by political parties, influential political personalities, then resign or forced, actually, for under pressure, forced to resign. And now there are three, this is the third public prosecutor. And in a way that who is to be damaged, it is the people who are being damaged, it is the country which is damaged, and it is a vicious circle. So this is I would like to comment on this aspect where the pressure is coming from political forces. And are there, for example, examples or stark examples in other countries? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming in. We really, really appreciate the richness of these experiences shared. And I can see a lot of nodding when all of you have spoken. So Abdul, allow me now to just summarize a couple of questions for the panelists to reflect while I'm going to hand over to Simon in 1 second. One question specifically to Gary about whether IEP is aware of a jurisdiction in which the principles of protection of prosecutors and their independence are articulated in domestic law. That question comes from my colleague Nick State. We have a question also, I think, for everyone, perhaps our Grace and Hermione in particular, about whether having a specialized anti-corruption authority with prosecutorial powers would perhaps help address the attacks, and also to what extent a strong judiciary could help deter attacks against prosecutors. And the final question to all the panelists, perhaps, for those who want to pick it up, comes from Ulrich Brown, and he's asking whether we could speak a little bit about challenges posed by modern spyware technology, phone hacking, laser microphones. I don't even know what a laser microphone is, goodness, to investigations and their impact on confidentiality. So I'm going to put those questions to you and let you reflect on them while I'm handing over to Simon, who's been having his hand up for a while. Simon, over to you.
I don't know what a laser microphone is either, but sounds interesting. Maybe I should get one for investigative purposes. thank you. Thank you very much to our Italian colleague who just joined. I think from our perspective, we're not in doubt around the constitutional points that you were making about the independence. I think it's just the concern we have had relates to a number of cases, not just this case, some of which have concluded. And it is that conclusion, together with the conclusion of the Court of the First Instance, that gives us concern as to whether or not Italy is falling out of compliance with the OECD Convention. That's a separate matter, I guess, to the main subject we're talking about here. With respect to attacks against prosecutors, just a slight deviation. Lamre, our colleague from Head of Resource Center in Nigeria, who referred to the situation with Magu, is too humble, I think, to mention that he himself has also been under attack. It's too long an explanation right now, other than just to sum it up. One of those indicted under the OPL 245 case in Nigeria, has managed to recruit himself a rogue police unit who've spent most of the last months, 9 months or so, harassing Lanre and his organization, which I would describe as one of the preeminent anti-corruption organizations in Nigeria. And to the point now where Lanre himself faces charges under the defunct cybercrimes law, essentially based on the publication of material which is the government's own position in court cases. And now the Attorney General himself, the current one, appears to have joined the fray on the side of those who've initiated this, which raises massive questions about the integrity of Nigeria's own anti-corruption fight. So going back to our colleague from Italy's point about bringing in civil society, I think there's a world out there that is, or a world I would like to see, where prosecutors should not feel isolated from the rest of society. We, the rest of society, however we construct ourselves, should be in the business of supporting our our anti-corruption efforts and the work of prosecutors, because we, the people, need to have faith in the integrity of judicial systems. And when you have prosecutors attacked on spurious grounds with no basis, whereas concerns raised about matters to do with concerns about the conduct of particular cases do not get investigated, even though material in the public domain suggests there is at least the grounds to do such an investigation, that does raise questions. And, maybe this is a hunch and not a scientific conclusion, but having spent 25 years looking at corruption situations in many countries, you can smell it when it stinks. And there is something that really stinks about the attempts that are currently going on, independent or not, of the focus on the prosecutors from the OPL 245 case in Milan, that really stinks. It smells to high heaven. And it really, someone needs to look into how that has come about and some of the other concerns that have been well mounted in the press. Just one last point on the press. And I think the press is critical as well. There are two newspapers and one TV network that has reported well on this case for the duration. The rest is utterly cowed by the prospect of ending up on the wrong end of a legal attack. Sorry, that's my dogs in the background. A legal attack from the company concerned. And that is a real problem, because it isolates prosecutors even more. So when they get attacked, their independence and their integrity can be thoroughly undermined by rubbish put out in the press that has simply become part of the band joining the corrupt in their efforts. And that's a real problem that we need to deal with. And I think that comes back to political will, resourcing, dealing adequately with the impunity side of all of this stuff that we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon, so much. I will, for the 2 minutes left, but we should maybe take 5 minutes max. But Gary, Hermione, and Graza, if I can ask you, perhaps starting with Gary, because there was a specific question to you, just a 1 minute kind of final point you wanted to make. Thank you.
To answer the specific question, I will be brief. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any jurisdictions that have specific legislation protecting journalists. And to, I guess, mirror Simon's word, we are prosecutors, we're part of society, and we're subject to the usual constitutional and legislative protections that all other citizens enjoy. That said, I refer to our IAP standards in my talk, and those standards, demand the physical and work-based protection of prosecutors, and all our organisational members, and that's 177 prosecuting authorities and associations across the world, have to sign up and comply with those standards. But the question does raise an interesting point about whether more need to be done to embed those protections in domestic law and international law. So an interesting question. Thank you.
Super. Thank you, Gary. And before I hand over to Hermione for her last 1 minute, I have just received intelligence from the COSP room to say that laser microphones are used to listen into conversations in buildings from a distance using a beam of invisible light. Glass carries sound, so it's pretty effective. So we've just learned something, certainly Simon and I have. Thank you, Alan, very much back there in Sharm. Hermione, could you come with your 1 minute concluding point?
The two questions I want to take a stab at. The one is, does special anti-corruption agencies, I suppose, better assist? And the second relates to the spyware. I think that the organization that I lead is billed as a specialist anti-corruption prosecuting and investigating and prosecuting body. And I certainly think that the focus, the specialization, those kinds of issues equip us better to mount some of these prosecutions. My sense, though, is I think Simon was explaining, when you have a specialist anti-corruption agencies, all sorts of rogue units spring up, and the spyware that is referred to gets trained on us, and we become the focus. So because if you take us out, that's it, you're sorted. I'm torn about whether a single agency or multiplicity of agencies, all focused on the same goal of eradicating corruption is better. But I think the bottom line is, as prosecutors, we know that, you don't choose this job for the money, for the all sorts of other conveniences in life. You choose it because it's a passion. You choose it because you believe in what you're doing, and you have that sense of satisfaction when you go to sleep at night that you're fighting the good fight. It's not easy. And so whatever support, and I think the kind of support provided by the Corruption Hunters Network is incredibly valuable, because it gives us a community of people to found, to share the experience, and because there's just not going to be a solution to all the challenges we face. But being able to share those with people around the world, I think, is one of the most invaluable things I've come across. And I think Billy certainly shares that view. So yeah, there are all sorts of novel ways, old spy ways and new spy ways to focus on destabilizing corruption efforts. But I think our allies in the media, our allies in civil society will continue, and we should continue fighting this fight. That's me. Thanks. Great.
Thank you, Hermione. And I'm kind of glad to say that it gives you a good feeling in the evening when you go to sleep, because that means occasionally you do get to sleep despite the fact of having this crazy job, right? And I do think that Graza probably knows has known many sleepless nights as well. So if I can give you the last minute, Graza, before I conclude the session, please.
Thank you. I would like to comment in the question about the strong judiciary. Yes, of course. I think that we have to address this problem when you're a prosecutor, you need to be clear in these two things. Under our law, you can't take away prosecutors because you charge them with any accusation, okay? Because that's the law. You can't, because that would be a very easy way to take away or to choose your prosecutor. Under our law, we have that in Costa Rica. But the other part of the I think that the way to handle this is because you hope to have a strong judiciary, an independent judiciary, and that gives me the final. I mean, I want to finish with the presentation that we had on the first part of the Norway very important. Comments that were given about support. Yes, I know that sometimes, as Hermione said, we can find not only prosecutors, but all kinds of public officers that could abuse of power, okay? But if you have support, if you feel that you have it and you effectively have it, you can sleep well at night, just thinking, okay, I have this problem, but I have the support and I know and I'm confident that it's going to be addressed in a good way. So I think that that's the thing that sometimes you can sleep well because of that.
Thank you so much, Greza. With that, allow me just to point one more attention, 10 seconds, to a comment made, which I find interesting, from Sierra Leone, to say that, of course, we often see corruption investigations as politically motivated, but accusing a corruption investigation of being politically motivated is also a really great idea to derail an investigation that may not at all be, but it's a great accusation to make. This is politically, you know, motivated. Everyone's going to step back from that. And I think it's an important one. I will have to conclude. We could go on forever. This session will be recorded, and provided that all the speakers are happy with it, we will make it publicly available on our website and on our YouTube channel and all those other things. I'd like to draw your attention also to another very relevant session that was held yesterday, organized by UFO and the Center for Civil and Political Rights, an excellent panel that was discussing the pros and cons of setting up a UN special rapporteur on anti-corruption. But the session was held very late in the evening and they weren't allowed to make it publicly accessible or widely publicized, so they really didn't have the audience that the session deserved. It has been recorded and it will be available on the U4 website, and I really encourage you, Gary was on that panel as well, to listen and widely disseminate that session and of course ours as well. Our most sincere thanks to the panelists. You've been absolutely amazing and thank you so much for really sharing your personal experience or speaking for those who are not able to speak, very much for fear of exactly the kinds of reprisals that we've spoken about today. I have to say the session hasn't helped in alleviating my very growing concern about lawfare that we have been speaking about. And because of that, I would really like to thank you all and those who you represent, all the courageous anti-corruption prosecutors and activists from civil society, media who are supporting organizations like the IAP, the Hunters Network. Thank you all for the sacrifice you make, which you make for all of us. We really stand with you and are enormously grateful for what you do. And with that, I wish you all a very good day. Keep up the fight. We are joined in this goal. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greta.
Thank you, Greta, and everybody else on the panel. And everyone listening who's a prosecutor, go for it.
Absolutely.
It was fantastic having you guys.
Thanks.
Speak soon. Take care. Good luck for your long day, Greta.
Thank you. Just beginning.
Exactly.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.